Welcome to Cloudlandia.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Jackson, I want to know, with all these calls that are recorded and transmitted, exactly what does that mean?
You see, once these calls are recorded, they're digitized, and they're ready for Cloudlandia. They're ready for the world.
Right. Well, I'm feeling very ready for Cloudlandia.
Are you? It's nice to be back.
Yeah.
Have you had a wonderful vacation?
Yeah, we were at the cottage, and we had every kind of weather.
All four seasons.
All four seasons, but delightful, you know. I don't mind.
Is your construction project going on?
Yep. It's finished. I mean, finishing the veranda. Yeah, it's completely finished and very nice. It's funny. We've lived in it for about 6 years, but we had this porch that they had created for the original log cabin house. We've expanded and renovated, but it was a useless porch. It was just a bare porch. Mm-hmm. It had a lot of space on it, but you wouldn't sit out there. And now that it's covered and it's got, you know, very nice chairs, and, you know, it's got double screens. So we have screens that are permanent. And then we have weather screens. Have you seen the weather screens?
I have not. Uh-uh.
Yeah. So they're outside and they're rolled up at the top, and then you press a button and then they come down on a track, and it gives you a double screen. And so if it's raining straight in or it's snowing straight in, none of it comes through the screens.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, God bless America and Canada.
Yeah. We had a vision.
And that
was a capability, and now we've taken ourselves out of reach.
Neither rain nor sleet nor snow can disturb your patio or porch endeavors.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
that's awesome. So, well, I love that.
I just
before we got on the call here, I had a little. Last night, I had what I'm going to go ahead and claim it as the very best brisket I've ever put in my mouth last night from a local guy who, Big Daddy, who makes it, you know, all right here, stays up all night making his brisket and selling it from a pop-up, you know, stand over here by Cypress Gardens Boulevard. And it was just so melt in your mouth, good and flavorful, and just one of the true delights of the mainland. You can't get a good brisket in Cloudlandia. You can only experience it on the mainland. And that's one of the joys of being on the mainland.
You know, it's important to point that out to people.
It's true. You can't get a good brisket in Cloudlandia.
Yeah. And my sense is that once they get the trick of it, people who are going to take the greatest advantage of Cloudlandia are the people who were already taking the greatest advantage of the mainland.
Well, certainly. I mean, this was kind of my thoughts in my journal today. I was over at the coffee shop just sitting and having a nice coffee and thinking Cloudlandia mainland thoughts. And it dawned on me, like I was looking at the distinctions between Cloudlandia and the mainland. And that there's, you know, you're really, there are some things that are completely separated from each other. But it seems like the biggest, like, opportunities are the things that are the intersection of Cloudlandia and the mainland, is using all the tools and advantages of Cloudlandia to serve and enhance your mainland business. Because most of the time, the people who have a mainland business are basically mainland centric in a way, you know, like I was thinking about what are the things that are uniquely and only mainland. And you know, there's some things like anything to do with your physical body that involves touching it or it having
the five senses.
Yeah, exactly. Eating sandwiches.
Whatever other senses, you know, I mean, like balance. I mean, we have a, it's never mentioned as the five salad, one of the five senses, but balance certainly seems to be crucial.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's never talked about. Yeah. It was very interesting because I've had fascinating discussions with individuals who, when they die, are having their body preserved and cryogenically, but they don't really do that.
Our own Joe Polish. Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is that they're only saving the head and the spinal column. They're not saving the entire body. And my point being, then if they bring you back, then what, how do you sense things? Because all the sensing organs you've removed. So if you're going to come back at some point, they're going to resuscitate. And what's the brain that comes back going to be using as input? As,
right, exactly. And how is it going to fuel it, glucose and all of the things that it runs on? Right. How are you going to create glucose without a liver? And
and brisket. I mean, brisket. Say goodbye to brisket.
How are you going to taste your brisket? That's exactly
that. This is a no brisket. This is a no. You're setting yourself up for a no brisket future.
That's the thing. That's one of the
almost takes a lot of joy out of the expectation, doesn't it?
Ah, that is right. So that's kind of the thing. That was my observation. That's certainly one category, is everything to do with the care and servicing of our meat robot. You know, that's really the thing. Mm-hmm. Those are, because wherever your meat robot is, that's where you are, you know, kind of.
Well, and meat's attracted to meat, you know, meat's looking for meat.
Oh, man. So that it was an interesting thought to like channel my thinking towards those things. And I started to think about like all of those things, physical, like you can't really, it's hard to be a chiropractor or a dentist in Cloudlandia because the teeth and the backs and necks are located in a geography. Mm-hmm. I was looking through the distinctions of, you know, in Cloudlandia, the divisions are in time zones. That's the only real division in terms of access. Wherever you're calibrating to somebody's day or night kind of thing. So time zones are the most, instead of setting up in regions, like physically being located in the UK or in China or wherever, you can serve all of those markets through shifting time zones, not geography, which is kind of that's something that you've discovered, being able to have Australia workshops by just shifting into being able to serve people in the time zone that's appropriate for that side of the world, you know? Whereas on the mainland, it's like a zoning in. There's far more kind of distinctions, starting with your physical address, where you are, like I guess you could even go lower to that, your GPS coordinates, where your iPhone can pinpoint you wherever you are on the planet, to your physical address, to your street, to your neighborhood, your zip code, your town, your county, your state, you know, all of those kind of varying telescopic, you know, view of geography. And there's a really interesting thing of when you take all the, you've got an opportunity, even if you are an only local business, to take all of the Cloudlandia elements and focus them only through that lens of this 15-mile radius of my podiatry practice. That I could be, as long as I'm internet famous in that 15-mile radius, that's the key. I don't need to be, as a podiatrist, world famous. You just need to be 15-mile famous, you know? And that I think, is, that's what's kind of exciting to me, because that's kind of been my magic formula of syndication, you know, of taking something that worked in Georgetown would equally work in the beaches, you know. So that's been
Well, you created an overlay, a digital overlay, way back. I mean, we're talking probably well before we, you know, started chatting. I mean, you had already done this, so that you could look at the beaches, and you create a level of abstraction, and the level of abstraction that you created was the different stages of home ownership that a single person, or a single, let's say a single couple would go through from, let's say, ages 20s through 80s, but not go out of the geographic area of the beaches. In other words,
that's exactly right.
The 60 years would be all spent in the mainland reality of the beaches. This is for those of you who are tuning in to Welcome to Cloudlandia, what we're referring to is the area of Toronto that I live in, and it's a beach community, and it's truly the only real beach community in Toronto, because it's got a beach, and it's got a boardwalk, and you have access, direct access to it, and the rest of the city is gradually getting there, because it was very industrialized down right on the lake, and now gradually there's a movement. Probably in 25 years, I would say a good deal of the, you know, the industrial lands will be gone, and they'll be converted into residences.
What's the latest on the Google Smart City or whatever plans that they had for Toronto?
That was voted down. That was voted down, and it was the requirements that Google had, that the people who lived there had to be connected to Google. And in other words, they had to be willing to be tracked and traced 24/7 by Google. So if they lived there, they were like a lab experiment. And they couldn't explain it well, why that was true. Why couldn't anyone live there? You know, because, you know, I mean, that, and then they were saying that we want the land for free because we're bringing so much good to the city of Toronto. And they tried to make a convincing argument that wasn't a compelling offer.
Now, that was on the land, that was kind of between you and the city center kind of thing, right?
Was, well, actually, it's more specific. It's basically the area Cherry Street, the Cherry Street that goes down into the big industrial area. It's still a big industrial area. It's being converted now, but it's the shoreline right to Red Path Sugar. You know, it's about, you know, 6-7 blocks, and you know, highly prized real estate if it's cleared and it's decontaminated, because there's a lot of industrial waste that they have to take out of the soil, so they have to reprocess the soil. But in the end, Google overstepped, and they sort of said, well, you know, this will be famous in the world, so why don't you just give us the land, and we'll do that. And the one phrase that just doesn't work in the city of Toronto is, you give us the land.
Right. How about you give us the land?
Don't you realize what a powerhouse we are in Cloudlandia? Why don't you just give us this piece of mainland, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
That's where you can really see the differentiation between the mainland and Cloudlandia when it comes down to a square foot of land in the city of Toronto.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, it didn't work, but it's developing, and the other concerns are going up. But if you came, they tore down the Gardner part that when you make the turn on the Gardner to go north on the Don Valley, mm-hmm. it was an extension that went out to the beaches.
Yeah, and they tore that down.
And that's all been torn down. That's all been torn wow. down. That you know, it's quite a long stretch. And what they're doing now from Cherry Street now to Commissioners, let's say you're going down to Commissioners, not really knowing how much you have an awareness because we see it every day. So we're pretty aware of it. But they're putting in the brand new condo housing in that area now for about mm-hmm. 10,000 people.
Wow.
And it's like probably the biggest project I've ever seen in the city of Toronto. It's just immense. You know, it's about two full industrial blocks along the, you know, along the shoreline, and then it goes about four blocks in down into the industrial.
Like another,
that's all been cleared. That's all been cleared now.
It's and like another extension of City Place or whatever they call that by the.
Yeah, the and tower, the other thing is that they're creating a new channel for the Don River. So they're obviously going to create like a Venice-like apparatus down there with a lot of bridges and everything.
Oh, my
so
goodness.
A lot of people. Well, you're on the, you know, you're close to the inland waterway in Florida. And the inland water, you know, the inland, sort of the waterway in Florida, you know, which goes pretty well right up the whole length of the state.
The whole perimeter, right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, proves that God loves real estate agents.
Yeah, that's the truth, isn't it?
You get three. Front,
but let's get another.
Yeah, you get
let's
three.
Put a little channel front. There.
Other people have one. Florida has three.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And, yeah. No, the perimeter of Florida is a wonderland. It's so amazing. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's the perfect example that all of that when you. You know, that the other thing I, you know, the other major category is where you physically live, your home ownership, everything around your physical dwelling in terms of whether you're renting or own and all of the maintenance and servicing and things that go along with home ownership. Those are purely, you know, mainland businesses and, you know, but the good news is that once you know, they're duplicatable. You know, that's kind mm-hmm. It's the difference between scalable and duplicatable. Like a primarily Cloudlandia business, like Strategic Coach. If you take away the physical workshops, the Strategic Coach, you know, Cloudlandia campus or division is really scalable. Right. Whereas the workshop model is duplicatable because mm-hmm. you've got the workshops and those are duplicatable in two ways through having other coaches teach the program mm-hmm. and people physically come into different locations. That's duplicatable, right?
Yeah, I was just looking. There was a Thursday on the calendar, I think it was sometime in July, and I was just looking, and there were eight workshops going that day. And
wow, right.
Five of them were physical, were mainland, and three of them were Cloudlandia workshops. Uh-huh. And it just struck me as interesting that was something that could happen in 2022 that wouldn't have happened in July of 2020. You know, like the whole global virtual is what we call that part of the program that you can, you know, if you have coaches for the day, I mean, we're still restricted. We have to have a team on the Zoom call. We have to have mm-hmm. a coach on the Zoom call. And so there's a certain amount of mainland organization that's required mm-hmm. mainland.
But it's much easier to manage 100 people. Than on Cloudlandia workshops, then it would be in person. That's a little bit of a bigger thing, you know, but you can instantly divide people up into threes and fours and instantly bring
200
them back.
Is our, 200 is our upper limit
yeah.
That we've established because you can have 50 breakout groups of 4 and 200.
Okay. There you go.
And that, can't have more than 50 breakout groups right now on Zoom. So
I didn't know that.
Four really works. And, you know, and it's no more difficult to have 50 groups of 4 than to have 5 groups of 4.
That's the truth. That's exactly right. That's kind of an interesting dynamic, right? So that would, you'd say that is, you know, 4 or 5 times the number of people that you'd have in a physical workshop.
Yeah, easily. Yeah. And that would be a good size mainland workshop. I mean, if you had 40, so that's a really good, but you could easily do that five times. It's taking a while for everybody's minds to, I had the benefit of conferring with you every week or so on this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have no problem. You know, people say, well, the in-person workshops are so much better. And I say, well, from a particular point of view, they are better. And mm-hmm. from another point of view, Zoom workshops are superior. You know,
absolutely. Well, just think about the economic. I just think about the economic impact of one workshop. If you take a 50 person in-person workshop where 80% of the people are coming from somewhere other than Chicago or Toronto or London mm-hmm. or LA, and having to fly to the yeah. place. And so if you're thinking most of the people in our workshop are going to be either flying business class or flying their own plane into the thing, or, and then hotel nights and the actual time margin of being able to be there for the thing, because it's really the day before and all of that day and evening of the workshop, at least four people, and your physical location and the number of people and the food, the brisket, man, the brisket. You can't, you don't have to serve brisket in Loudlandia either. So it's kind of although, you know, I spoke at one conference, which was pretty interesting. This was for a REMAX group in Mississauga, actually. They had 500 agents, but they had their people. They did their summit in Zoom, and they had set up with Uber Eats to buy lunch for everybody on the workshop. So they set mm-hmm. at a lunch time, but 30 minutes before the lunch break, they had a break and said, we're going to take a 10-minute break, and we've forwarded, you know, texted your coupon, your code for Uber Eats that is good for the next 30 minutes. Or whatever, so you can order your lunch right now, and it will arrive as we're ready to take the lunch mm-hmm. break. Mm-hmm. So the code, that this code was for anything that got ordered in the next 30 minutes, and then it cut off. And mm-hmm. I thought that was a really interesting use of, way of doing things. And so that was, but that, again, the logistics of that, so much easier than physically having to cater something, you know?
Yeah, well, the thing is that when a capability is created, then different people see opportunities to it. And by the way, I'm about 2/3 the way, actually 90% way through the book that you recommended, The Big Change.
And how do you like it?
Well, first of all, it's a beautifully written book. I mean, he's a wonderful writer. And
he's got a whole series of them too. He's got a whole series.
From the standpoint of amazing changes, and these are mainland changes, and there were Cloudlandia changes too, because radio came in and television came in, and lots of other things came in. But it would be a solid bet to say that there was more fundamental change between 1900 and 1950 and between 1950 and the year 2000.
The former.
I think you could make a very solid case.
That was my assertion when we started looking at these things, like all the things getting up to, because by 1950, let's call television the peak of the, you know, content distribution, where we, you know, between Gutenberg, when print became distributable, there was the 400 years between Gutenberg and the phonograph.
And
right on the heels of the phonograph, you had the photograph and then the moving images and then radio and then telephone and electricity. Yeah. All of those things converged to get us to 1950, where you could distribute print, pictures, audio, video, and you know, over the airwaves, right to a box in everybody's house. And then I have, we look at it really from 1950 to 1985, probably, we had this homogeneous experience that was only just the evolution of the application of those things. Like when you look at that television in, you know, as it between 1950 and 1960, the huge growth of the number of televisions that were, you know, in the United States at the time was, you know, almost at the peak kind of thing. You know, everybody was watching the same shows. Everybody, I saw an infographic one time that showed, you know, in 1960 or 55, 58, whenever I Love Lucy was the number one show on television and had like 80 million viewers, right? Everybody watched I Love Lucy. And then Gunsmoke was one of those. And then in the 80s, when cable kind of came onto board, you know, the Cosby Show was the top show on television, but it had dropped to about 50 million as the top show. By 2000, the number one show was American Idol, and it had 30 million people. And then we tipped, then Cloudlandia came in, and there's only three or four shows on television right now that get a dependable 10 million audience. So but the consumption, you know, of the streaming and all the access to everything was unbelievable. And so I look at it that now those, the big change, if we take what the approach that, for people listening to the book, is The Big Change, America Transforms Itself, 1900 to 1950 by Frederick Lewis Allen. And it was written in 1952 and is phenomenal. And that's the book that Dan and I are talking about. But I would say from, you know, the year from 1985 to 2020, you know, 22, where we are right now, I would call 2020 as the big shift, because that's where everything became available. That I would argue that going forward, we're entering a period now where it could be 30 years of just the same, just the expansion of using the existing platforms that are available now. Like everything, like there's not going to get, I don't know where, how it gets any better for any of the things that we look at as the staples of asynchronous communication, meaning books or print or text, audio, video, all of those things, that we're at the point where it's basically you have access to everything ever written instantly on your smartphone, wherever you are. Same thing with every song or minute of audio ever recorded is available at your fingertips just for summoning with your voice. every song ever written. I could just yell out to my thing, Alexa, play, you know, what's the first song you remember ever hoping came on the radio, Dan? I mean, when you, back in your young days exploring the radio waves from, you know, Chicago or wherever you were tapping into with your exploring the world.
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's late 40s and early 50s, and it was,
do you remember the song? Do you remember any songs that were like?
Oh yeah.
What was your
I don't remember a particular song, but I remember a particular female.
Got a lovely bunch of coconuts.
No, it was Joe Stafford, who had been a big band singer, and she was one of the few big band singers that successfully. Frank Sinatra was the first.
Yeah,
Frank Sinatra was the first big band singer who then went solo and became bigger than the band. You know, that you had Frank Sinatra was the greatest first solo radio artist, recording artist, and radio artist. And that happened in the early 40s. And he went out and did it. But in the females, there were several. Joe Stafford was one. Doris Day was the second one. Yeah, Patty, I'm trying to think her name, Patty Page. So there was a whole series. And they started to really get big right around 1950. And then you had the movement from rhythm and blues into rock and roll really starts around 52. And it started in Cleveland, actually. That's why Cleveland's got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because a disc jockey by the name of Alan Freed, there was a big event with a lot of different artists coming to Cleveland. And he said, we're going to, you come on down, we're going to rock and we're going to roll. And that's captured on recording that he said this. And that, that was the birth of rock and roll. Yeah, it was spoken. And that started in that.
Birth of story.
Of the which?
I love a good birth of story. That's a good
Well, that's actually the first time it was spoken, rock and roll.
Yeah.
And the play that, and Babs and I have been participating in with Jeff Madoff, which is called Personality, is the story of Lloyd Price. He's considered the first person who walked across the bridge from rhythm and blues into this new world of rock and roll. And the whole point was it coincided with a technology called the 45. And all of a sudden, the teenagers became the big market for the first time. American teenagers became the big market for recorded music. Up until that time, it had been an adult medium.
The baby boomers. That was the first. That was the first thing about the baby.
And these
boomers,
wouldn't have been bad. These wouldn't have been boomers. These would have been my generation, which was the. My generation is from 1928 to 1946, so I was born right at the end of it. But it would have been individuals who were born in the 30s, who became the first, you know, the teenagers. If you were a teenager in 1952, you were 14 years old, so you'd been born in 1938. And but the other thing is that he was the first black musician in the United States who had a white teenage audience. This was not only a music revolution, but it was a social revolution. It was a political revolution. And so that had a huge impact. Rock and roll had a huge impact socially and politically on the United States.
Did you see did you see the Elvis movie, by the way?
I haven't seen it. No, I haven't seen it.
Really well done. Yeah, it's really well done. I mean, it tells a great story. Tom Hanks playing Colonel Parker. It's really that story is the collaboration between Colonel Parker and Elvis. So yeah, it was neat to see kind of firsthand what you're talking about there. Cause that was, you know, the radio, getting on the radio, but then people being able to see him on television shaking those hips, Dan.
Yeah. He was actually censored by Ed Sullivan that the camera angle couldn't be below the hips.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I can remember I went to Catholic grade school and high school, and I remember the nuns being alert to this, and they said, don't you be watching this type of music. Don't you be listening to this goodness. Type of music. It leads to sin, and they were right. It did.
Oh, that's so funny.
But I will tell you from the book, that Big Change book, it strikes me that if I had to pick one technology that changed America the most, it was the car.
Yes. Yeah, mobility, right? That's the thing.
Mobility. About independence and mobility.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, you got everything packed. You got about 10 different wants that are packed into one, you know. You get to get out of your town. You get to get away from your parents. You got your own private room on wheels. But what's wrong with that?
And that's kind of, so it's an interesting thing when you look at what, if we were taking this same thing, if Frederick Lewis were alive right now and talked about the big change from 2000 to 2022, what would be the, you know, and I think that it's access, right? Like, I think.
Yeah, it's the internet and probably the cell phone.
Yeah.
The internet, they're the two drugs. Yeah. And the thing, he did a very good job of describing why Ford was such a big pioneer. He talked about six or seven different technologies, all merged at the time of Henry Ford and his assembly line. And the other thing was the remarkable thing that Ford pulled off, which probably changed things unbelievably, was that he kept lowering the price of the car, but he kept increasing the salaries of his employees.
Yeah, trying to get more, create more people who could afford cars.
Well, he wanted the people who made them.
Yeah.
The people who made them to be the customers. And the other thing, he doesn't mention it, and I found it surprising that he didn't, but Henry Ford actually created the weekend because everybody works 6 days a week. And he said if they're working 6 days a week, they aren't going to want to spend Sunday driving around. So he said, let's give them an extra day. And we take their salaries higher and we give them an extra day. Yeah. Almost sounds like strategic coach, you know. It's
make more, work less, right?
You know, take more free days, you'll make more money. And you know, for the rest of his life, he had to walk around with bodyguards because the other manufacturers really wanted to do him in, because his doubling the work salary just really went right through industry. And you know, like everybody said, let's get in on this double salary and then give him an extra day off. So you could say he's a pioneer in technology, but he changed things socially and politically.
Yes.
And economically.
Yeah. Amazing. Kind of it's a fun thing. You know, that does sound like strategic coach. I had to realize that, you know, so many of these strategic coach tools, Dan, fit with this exploration I've been doing on imagine if you applied yourself. You know, I've been parsing.
You know, if you put the message that you got from your teachers and combine it with the message that I got from my teachers, we've got sort of a really, yours was imagine if he applied himself. And mine was he has no respect for authority.
All right. I love that. And those things.
Actually, I think the two go together. In order to apply yourself, you have to have no respect for authority.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing where you know, I've been parsing out the individual words of that and looking at each of them as a, you know, a distinct thing. And, you know, where the block is. And I think if you just take even the first thing, imagine, is your ability to visualize a bigger future, a thing that you, something that you like, the ability to even have a vision that's bigger than or different than what your current situation is. Most people, if you just isolate that skill of being able to think that way without filtering through logistics goggles or thinking, well, I don't have the money for that, or there's no, I don't have that, I don't have the skills for that, or whatever, just to, you know, I think about your book, Wanting What You Want, and the whole idea of getting, you know, creating that it's okay to allow yourself to think of vision, the skill of recognizing, so seeing a vision that, regardless of whether it's within your current capabilities or not, to allow yourself to think unencumbered with the limitations that you see of yourself right now is a big thing. And I think that a lot of people don't have that, or they don't allow themselves play at that level.
Yeah, I think your second point is the operable one. Do I have permission to do this? Okay, yeah. Because there's physical constraints, which are actually much easier to deal with than social constraints. Okay, because physical restraints are outside of you, but social constraints are inside of you. You bought into somebody else, you know, and that's why I say it's very important when you say, I want this, not to say, because the moment that you use the word because, you're trying to justify it within the framework of what other people will approve of, what other people will allow you to do.
And if you take the first three, imagine if in you, and if being what you were saying there, if is, let's separate completely the vision and let's spend our time imagining that anything is possible without any constraints. If you can see it, you can have it, kind of thing. What would that look like, right? Then the if is, then what physically has to happen in order for the...
Yeah, and then if you add who...
There's where you get into the who, not how, but...
Well, exactly, because the biggest constraint for the most part is you don't have the capabilities, you don't have the skills. But who, not how? Who, not how, you know, because
that's
the,
because
I think the biggest skill out of this whole thing that we're talking about is actually the skill of imagining something irregardless of whether other people are okay with that.
Right. That's the thing, like Peter Diamandis, the vision of space travel, you know, of having a space that can go and come back and go up again. That was like an outrageous vision. And do you have, you know, there's no idea how to make that happen, or who do you need authority? Who needs to give you permission to do that or whatever? That opens up this whole other world of if. And then by creating the X Prize, he gets all these other people engaged in figuring out the if for that vision. He just set the vision. Here's the vision. We're going to have a spacecraft that can go into space, come back, land, and next week do it again. That's the vision. And then not knowing how, that's the if of all of this. If that's going to be true, then this and this, it's almost like a strategy school, Dan, where you think about it's VODA, right? Vision, opposition, transformation, action. That's the cell with this imagine if. And then you is the self-awareness of what are your capabilities and strengths and the things that, you know, what are right in your go zone, your unique ability of this. And then applied is making the decision. This is what we're going to move towards.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah, and and I just say this as a line I drop in the workshops. I said, you know, your future can be as big as you want it to be if you're not the perfect person to do the house.
Right.
You know, I mean, if the condition is that you have to do it, you have a very limited future. Are you there?
Yeah, you cut out for a second. You said that your future can be as big as you want if you're not the one that has to do it.
do the house.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
And people laugh at it, and I say, well, I mean, first of all, compare where you are today with where you were 25 years ago in regard to having to do the house. How many of the houses have been totally taken care of now, 25 years later, that you can plan much bigger because you know you have the capabilities available to you to do that without you having to do it?
Yeah. Yeah.
In my sense, this is where the great inequality is on the planet. You know, I've been, there's this tension, you know, about all people being created equal. And my feeling is that it's a speculative equality. And what I mean by that, if you played the game right, and if you used your mind in a certain way, you're not really restrained or constrained by any particular obstacle. I mean, if you're born in the wrong part of the planet and you can't do it there, you can imagine that you could live in another part of the planet. So funny, I was watching Bill Maher, who I enjoy. I doubt if we've ever gone into the voting booth and voted the same party in our life, but I really enjoy talking to him or listening to him. And he said that he found going to Florida and being in Florida for a month was the freest he's ever felt as a U.S. citizen.
How interesting.
Yeah, he says incredibly freer than New York City, incredibly freer than Los Angeles and Hollywood. He said people can come to Florida with the biggest possible dreams and you can go from there. And that's where I see the real competition going forward now is the states are in the United States are going to become hyper competitive with each other in terms of who provides the most freedom.
As our countries, I think. Like you look at now Estonia, for instance, reshaping themselves as kind of a digital citizenship, you know, where they're gathering people who are kind of world citizens, digital ads, and creating an opportunity for people to have digital citizenship.
It's an experiment, you know. It's an experiment. But it's all experiments, if they are successful, start with the notion of greater freedom.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I heard somebody say, talking about, you know, the thing of that where people are trying to get off the grid, you know, kind of thing, people who are afraid of the, you know, the digitization of the world, the surveillance state, and, you know, everything being localized, you know, that their temptation to try and get off the grid, and their counter to that is getting on as many grids as they can. having 15 driver's licenses and having different citizenships and residences and, you know, banking, being in different banking systems and, you know, being completely like just shiftable within the grander, you know, global context.
Yeah. And the one thing I tell people, don't forget about cash. Always make sure you have lots of cash. You know, it was so funny. Babs was going to Yorkville yesterday and she said, do you have any cash? And I said, right. Just stand right here. I'll be right back. And I've got about 5 different ATM spots in the house where I keep cash. And I came back.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I had 20 brand new 20s, and I gave her it. I said, will this do, madam? And she said, yes. And I said, do you need a receipt? Do you need
That's
a receipt?
Funny. Stay right here and close your eyes. Yeah.
This will be fine. And I said, you know, actually, one of the explanations for the underemployment factor, there's big underemployment factor in the states right now, you know, that it's just really hard to get workers. But that doesn't mean that people aren't working. They're not working in a way that their payment shows up on the grid.
Yeah.
And my feeling is that the amount of cash in play right now since COVID started, it has probably taken the I'll use the U.S. as the example. It's taken the U.S. back to how much of the economy was in cash 5 years ago or 10 years ago. There's just an enormous amount of cash in play. And,
do you think
the trades,
more,
like Plum, yeah, more so than ever. And they're just not showing up as being employed, you know. And, you know, skilled trades, for example, plumbing, carpentry, electricians, and that. I bet there's an enormous amount of cash trade. And they have people who work 10 hours, 15 hours, and agreed on cash payment. And it's less than if they were being paid but no tax. They're not being regulated, you know.
And so
my sense is that once something is created, it won't go away. It'll just be used in more highly specific and highly strategic ways. You know, in other words, so I always say, don't get caught short on cash. You know, make sure you have tons of cash.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And people say, cash? I've never used cash. And I said, then they've got a complete picture of everything you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
But it's endless what we're talking about here. You know, here's a really good example of the difference between Cloudlandia and mainland.
Yep.
So for years now, since 9/11, okay, so that's 21 years ago, they knew that there were two Al-Qaeda leaders. One of them was Osama bin Laden, and the other one was Zawahiri, okay? And this Zawahiri was this mysterious guy in the background, okay? So then they go after Osama bin Laden because he was the big mouth, you know, the big mouth who talked about everything, and they caught up with him in Pakistan, you know, living in his own compound. And obviously the government there knew that he was there. But last Saturday night, they caught up with Zawahiri. Okay, so here's a good example of the difference between so he was in Kabul in Afghanistan, and he was living in the wealthiest part of the city. I don't know when he arrived there, but anyway, he decides to go out and stand on the balcony of his house, which was, you know, an affluent home, and a predator drone at about 40,000 feet spots him, and they send a missile that's not an explosive missile. It's a meat grinder missile.
A meat grinder missile?
Yeah, what it does, it's got six Ginzu knives that just rotate very rapidly. And so what it does, there's no collateral damage. The building, it put a hole in the roof of the balcony. Yeah. And there was a hole in the balcony where he used to be. And then there's remnants of skin and flesh and blood. And they just, it just turns him to ground beef. He disintegrated. His ground. There was just a pink mist after he was killed. And I say that's a perfect example because all the work up until then to spot him was probably done in Cloudlandia.
Yeah.
But the missile itself was pure mainland.
Right. Boy, that is something. I mean, you know, wow. I had no idea that happened. That was just...
Yeah, because they get bad name because if they send an explosive, it knocks out the house, it wrecks the neighborhood, it kills 30 or 40 other people who are plausibly innocent. And here, they just took him out. They just took him
out. Vaporized him. Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So that there's a way where there's a coordinate. Obviously, there was probably local people who saw him who are in the know and they sent the message on, but then the actual spotting of him and everything else. And the Afghans, you know, they were saying, we had no idea he was there. And I said, well, you know, whether you did or not, he isn't there anymore. So anyway, but what it does, it sort of sends you a message, you know, if you're a person that might be on the outs with the United States, you got to watch which balconies you walk out on. But that's kind of an example of mixing the two worlds.
Yes. I was thinking when you were talking about, you know, you mentioned July 2020 is when you did the first sort of virtual ones. I wonder if COVID had only been that one loop of we were, you know, everybody stayed in and we flattened the curve and it went away, whether you would have still pursued or gone down that path of Zoom workshops or virtual workshops, or whether the world would have been as ready for that.
Yeah, I think the latter statement is the actual key one, is that Zoom really worked because the world had adapted it. It wasn't because we had adapted it.
Right. Yeah, that's the truth.
I mean, you knew how to use Zoom.
Yeah.
You knew how to use Zoom. I knew how to use Zoom. Right. There was no learning on our part. We knew how to use Zoom. It's just that nobody was at the other end.
Right. That's right. It's like being the only, we're like the only two people with a fax machine, faxing each other.
Yeah. After. Yeah. I'd send through a fax. Anything original today, Dean? I got to think about it. Okay. Well, let me know when you do. Yeah.
So funny.
Yeah. No, it's Metcalfe's law, you know, the economic value of a electronic medium is the number of connected users squared.
Yeah.
So if you have two, it's two times two, it's four. That's the economic value. If it's 2 million, it's 2 million times 2 million, which is a really big number.
That's something.
All right. Well, I'll have some exciting things to talk about because I'm going on Peter Diamandis' deep dive into medical science this week. So we.
That's right. Where is it this
week? We go to San Francisco. We go start on Tuesday morning and we finish off on Sunday night. So it's 6 days.
Yeah, maybe
San
you're.
Francisco and San Diego.
Maybe that your jet buddy might close you.
Oh, he's there.
That's what I'm saying.
No, he's flying us from San Francisco to San Diego. Yeah. So
right.
We're going. Yeah.
That's what I mean. And while he's there, he might close you on the needing it from Toronto to Chicago.
I got a feeling I'll close him before he closes me.
Okay. There you go. Perfect. I love it.
Yeah.
All right, Dan, we're not on next week. And,
no, but 2 weeks. 2 weeks from now.
Yeah. Perfect. Look forward to it. Okay.
Okay, bye.
Thanks, bye.